Hey, I was wondering, are you doing anything tonight? Are you free?
No, I'm not doing anything tonight. Why?
You want to go out on a date?
Ooh, a date, huh? Actually, yeah, I did have plans. I have plans.
Plans with what?
Actually, I have plans with my radio.
Your radio?
Because I'm listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Oh, well, we could listen to KUCI in Irvine together.
No.
Hi, this is Rich Murata, Southern California Sports Broadcasters Hall of Famer. And if you've ever thought of making a donation to KUCI, now is the time to act. You can help keep their outstanding lineup of free-form, free-speech radio on the air and online simply by calling 949-824-5824 or by visiting UCI's giving site at kuci.org and making a donation.
Not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Good morning and welcome to this November 6th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. This is a critical week for KUCI. It's our semi-annual KUCI fund drive. Barbara, Nicole, and I are all here today together to stress the importance of today. It's one of the few times a year we come to you asking you to give back to us for the great programming you receive all the way through the year. Barbara?
Hello.
Hello. Are you excited for the fun diet?
Oh, I'm just thrilled. But well, mostly, you know, we have to do this because the university doesn't support the station other than giving us this wonderful little trailer. And if we want to keep the lights on and we want to use the phone and have water and parking and all kinds of wonderful things that help all of us volunteers to do this job, we need to have a station to come to.
And we're willing to give back even to you. For a $35 donation, we have a lot of advanced reader's copies of books. We are giving away both of the books that we're hosting today on the show. Robert Olin Butler is going to be here in just a moment. The Star of Istanbul is his latest novel. We have that as a premium to give away for your $35 donation. Russell Banks will be on in the second half hour, and his new collection of short stories, A Permanent Member of the Family, which isn't even out yet, comes out next week. We are offering that for $35. We've got yoga classes. We've got gift certificates to restaurants. We've got great, great, great stuff, all for $35. But if you've only got, you know, $5, $10, we'll take that too.
We'll take it.
We'll take that too. And for $100, you can come be a guest host or a co-host. Sit in with us and see how this crazy, exciting life works. So,
824-5824. 949 is the area code. We're here answering phones, and also you can go to kuci.org and just donate online. It's all tax deductible, and it's that time of year where you need to get some deductions going, so why not donate to us?
Love it, love it. All right, we're going to be here the entire hour taking your calls. Both Barbara and Nicole are here answering the phones. 949-824-5824, 949-UCI, KUCI. On with the show. I will be listening for the sweet sound of the phone ringing as we press in. In the spirit of great programming, it's my pleasure to welcome Pulitzer Prize winning author Robert Olin Butler to the show this morning. And coming up in the second half hour, as I mentioned, Russell Banks will be here. Robert Olin Butler is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of 14 novels, including The Hot Country, Hell, and A Small Hotel. He is also the author of 6 short story collections, including A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, which won the 93 Pulitzer Prize in fiction, and a book on the creative process, From Where You Dream. He has twice won a National Magazine Award in fiction and received the 2013 F. Scott Fitzgerald Award for Outstanding Achievement in American Literature. He teaches creative writing at Florida State University. His latest novel is The Star of Istanbul. It's published by The Mysterious Press. Again, with your $35 donation, we have exactly one copy of it available to you as a thank you premium for your donation. Goes to the first caller who requests it. It's my pleasure to welcome Robert on this morning. Robert, hi.
Hey, how you doing? By the way, whoever contributes, as everyone in Irvine should, to your station. I'll send you a signed autographed bookplate to stick inside that book. How's that?
Oh, that's fantastic. We love that. Thank you so much.
Love that.
So I'm going to let you talk about the star of Istanbul, Christopher Marlowe Cobb, and how this book and the series came to be. Can you introduce it for us a little bit?
Sure. I guess the thing to do is to go back and talk. You know, this book came about the same way its predecessor, The Hot Country, came about, which goes all the way back to a book I wrote in 2004, which is called Had a Good Time. And that book was a collection of short stories that I wrote from my collection of old picture postcards. And these cards I collected not so much for the images on the front, but for the messages on the backs, although one of those cards had a rather striking image on the front as well. And what went on in this postcard was what they call a real photo postcard in the postcard collecting business in the early part of the 20th century. By the way, postcards were fabulously popular, and also the Brownie camera had come along, and people would take their own photos and print them on postcard backs. And this card had a picture of a guy in a white shirt and dark trousers, and we see him from the back, and he's walking on a sidewalk, and it's clearly in a Spanish-speaking city because the run of shops are all in Spanish. And in the middle distance is this little gaggle of people, and mostly women. And the writer of the card has drawn an arrow pointing at one of those women. Further up, way in the distance, you can see from behind a guy in a military uniform on horseback. And all of this added up. And on the message on the back was, after the battle, notice the pretty señoritas in this photo. The one in white does my laundry. And what he's not mentioning in that inscription, and nor indeed is he even looking at in the picture, nor have I mentioned yet, is that as he's walking, he's passing, as that photo was snapped, hardly more than arm's length away, on the sidewalk, two dead Mexican men lying in pools of blood.
Mm.
And what I took the card to be, and I think accurately, because this was the heyday of postcards, it was 1914, and this is an image from the battle being the invasion of Veracruz, Mexico, and indeed the invasion of Mexico, by the United States in April of 1914, some months before Woodrow Wilson famously kept us out of that war for several years. He actually invaded Mexico because we didn't like the dictator running the country, and in order to protect American oil interests, and we fully expected the Mexican people to welcome us with open arms as liberators. So this is an old American tradition, as it turns out. Anyway, this guy I took to be a war correspondent covering that invasion, and I loved his voice. And it stuck around in my head for about 8 years, and something was brewing in me with him. And the catalyst was a guy named Otto Penzler, who is the dean of American book editors in the realm of mysteries, spy, espionage, suspense, and thriller books. And he called me one day. He had just brought his personal imprint, the Mysterious Press, over to my longtime publisher, Grove Atlantic. He called me and said, Bob, I just read this short story. I want to offer you right now a two-book contract for at least two novels in that guy's voice. Wow. And being of a literary turn of mind, I think my exact quote was, oh boy, you betcha. Because I loved the voice. I knew there was more in him. That voice had come to me in the most literary of ways, in that it was a voice that was actually speaking from my deepest conviction about our present zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. And I decided that indeed there were many novels about him, and I started a series, The Hot Country last year, Star of Istanbul right now. I have just stepped away to answer the phone for you from my writing desk, where I am 90,000 words into Cobb number 3, which will be called The Empire of Night. You heard it here first.
Wow.
And I'm really taking them as like a multi-part novel in the same character's voice, and he is definitely evolving and tapping into things that I think are not only of the beginning of the 20th century, but very much of the beginning of the 21st as well. The major issues that are going on in the world and in these books are very much the major issues that are going on now.
Had you dabbled in the thriller genre before? Is this your first time?
I have dabbled in, interestingly, over my career, I'm a literary writer, and I still am, but I've always embraced the so-called genres. As a fiction, I've already been a fictionist of sci-fi, a book called Mr. Spaceman.
Mm-hmm.
A book a few years ago I wrote entitled Hell was set entirely in hell and can only be called fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book called Wabash, set during the Depression. Young adult, I have a 16-year-old narrator in The Deuce. Sex, They Whisper, certainly deals with that. And romance, A Small Hotel a few years ago was an Oprah Magazine, O Magazine Book of the Week, and they called it a new old-fashioned romance. So I've always found that in my artistic unconscious, the way that I see the world in the deepest way was often inextricably bound up in the forms of the popular culture, you know. And as the great Ella Fitzgerald song says, "'Tain't what you do, but the way that you do it." Mm-hmm. And this is my first published venture, certainly into espionage, but I've always, in thrillers, but I've always, you know, certainly loved the genre. I mean, Graham Greene,
yeah,
who is one of the novelists I love the most, and he, too, is a literary writer, but he wrote these books, which even overtly called entertainments, although several of them, Stamboul Express most prominently, I think, are every bit as so-called literary as any of his other books. I've absorbed the genre, and but this, you know, these two books are certainly my first crack at them.
Are there a lot of rules to know about the genre that you feel like you have to master before you go into it?
No. Whatever common or you know, frequent occurrences or tropes there are in the genre, whatever, you know, in my reading of them and appreciating them, of them, whatever there were of those were absorbed into my artistic unconscious, where art comes from, and they came out in their own way and in their own time. The literary book does not. This is one of the distinctions between the artistic impulse and the entertainment impulse, is that the artist does not know what the book will be or what it will say until it's written. And so the willful application of events or whatever, anything, any major element in the book, it's just not the way I write, and so they have come in quite naturally. But I go back to the zeitgeist, which is what artists write from, and if you look at the world around us, it's a world of terrorist attacks, you know, secretly planned and secretly thwarted, the theft of top secret information, tracking down and assassinating of enemies, high seas piracies, mass murders, governments falling and rising by conspiracy and revolution. I mean, I'm just, you could probably find examples of those just in the last week or two of CNN.
Right.
And they're all given a kind of the TV news pace in short bursts. That's how we absorb the world now, with high drama. The espionage thriller form, for me, is it's how we are seeing the world in this era in many ways.
Mm.
And so all of this has come quite naturally to me.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Robert Olin Butler. The book that is the second in his Christopher Marlowe Cobb series is The Star of Istanbul. It is out and available now. We have one copy of it available for your $35 donation. Our phones are so quiet, so give us a call, 949-824-5824. Barbara and Nicole are here, and we have one copy of Bob's book here. I want to get back to this concept of the vintage postcards, because I feel like you've used that. I know there was a short story project that you did that I'd love to talk about as well. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you've been collecting these postcards, and they've been stimulus for a lot of your work.
All the work in one book. That book had a good time, had 15 stories in it, and each of them was based on a postcard. And we printed the front and back of the card. And I picked up, and all of the cards were written between 1906 and 1917, and that was the heyday of postcards. In that era, it was before telephones were at all common, in fact, even before telephones for a time, and yet in every city and town in the United States, there were at least two mail deliveries a day. And travel, even locally, was difficult and time consuming. It's before cars, mostly, but somebody could get a passing thought or feeling, and write it in a very condensed form, 20, 30 words, on the back of a postcard, and send it in the morning, and get a reply in the afternoon, or by the next morning,
It's like early tweeting.
It's exactly what it was. It is the early 20th century's tweeting or email, and I loved these cards, and it was a very labor-intensive hobby, because I would, spend a lot of time reading the backs of cards and postcard collectors. It's the third largest collectible in the world, the third biggest collectible hobby.
Wow.
But none of the dealers, sorted their cards by this. And so I read a lot of cards. But I had in my collection over 13, 14 years before I finally decided to write this book, a couple of hundred cards where on the back, these little outbursts of self and of feeling and circumstance and embedded narrative. And as I said in that book, then I chose 15 of my favorite cards and then rendered the full story. That was beneath the subtext of these cards.
Yeah, that's great. So I should mention that in the fall of 2001, you did something I think is admirable. I want to sit down and watch all of these.
Mm-hmm.
But you did a webcam cast of.
Mm-hmm.
17 two-hour sessions where you showed every step of the writing process of writing a literary short story, and you gave kind of a running commentary of your artistic choices and whatnot, and took questions, and you can download this on iTunes under the title is Inside Creative Writing, and I want to do this.
And you can actually get it on YouTube now as well. They're all out there in the public domain on YouTube. You just do Inside Creative Writing and or my name, and you can find them. And that was, you're right, you've connected that to the postcard book. It was based on a postcard. I had just begun to write that book, and so it was a perfect opportunity. I came in on the first night of that project and had some of a little grouping of cards that were particularly speaking to me, and I chose the card, and so it began from the first inspiration and to the final polished story in those 17 sessions.
How representative was that webcast to your writing process in general? Would it apply to novel writing as well?
Absolutely, yeah, certainly would. And it was quite representative, other than the fact that I was in a kind of schizophrenia where I would immerse myself in the absolutely focused, utterly concentrated trance state that is required to tap into your artistic unconscious when you write, literature. And yet, I would do something that I realized in the doing of it it would be useful to explicate, and then I'd step out of the trance and speak to my virtual audience there, and there were thousands who watched it live, and speak to them of my choices. And meanwhile, people were encouraged to write email questions, not make suggestions, because this was to, you know, be the process, and that was, it's a solitary process, but they could ask questions. And so the last half hour of each two-hour session, at the hour-and-a-half mark, one of my grad students who had been screening the questions would bring some questions up to me, and I would answer those. So there were those artificialities about it, but what you saw, you watched the words go up on the screen. All the lousy, rotten initial sentences get worked over and worked over and worked over. And my process was congenial to this because, as that Graham Greene, who I've mentioned a moment ago, once said, "All good novelists have bad memories." He says, "What you remember comes out as journalism. What you forget goes into the compost of the imagination." And that's that unconscious spoken of a couple of times that you write from as an artist. But my good novelist bad memory is so bad that I kind of forget my sentences as I write them. So I'm able to go back and work my sentences over, even within the trance state, which is what you need to do to rewrite. Rewriting is really redreaming what has become too willful or willed. And so, as I say, you could watch in this process, and that was absolutely the same as my process for novel writing. You can watch the elements of narrative that were essential coming in into the work, and the process of refining the sentence-to-sentence movement through the book, yeah, or through the story.
Compost of imagination. I love that. You can use that. You have said Christopher Marlowe Cobb is closer to you personally than any other character you've written. Biographically, that's true. Maybe you can expand on that for listeners. But
sure.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's psychologically true as well, and what that experience is sort of like of kind of writing from the inside out.
Well, I think all artists write from the inside out, but as Green suggests, you write from the inside of you that has been forgotten, that has dissolved itself out of literal memory and into its intense sensual component parts. So in that way, it's all from you, but you know, eventually, if you're good enough at this and you do as follow as the great Japanese film director Kurosawa said, that to be an artist means never to avert your eyes. And if you don't avert your eyes and you continue to write every day, you can break through to a place where you can transcend the surface similarities to yourself in creating characters. However, at this late stage, I've come to a character who I was. Now, Christopher Marlowe Cobb is an investigative newspaper reporter, war correspondent, turns into an American Secret Service agent. He comes from a theatrical family. His mother is a famous actress. And I was, for 13 years, an investigative business journalist, and for 10 years, the editor-in-chief of an investigative business newspaper. I was gobbled up in the pre-lottery day draft and was sent off into the Army, and they sent me to language school for a year, and I learned Vietnamese fluently, went into Vietnam in military intelligence, was de facto a spy in Vietnam, as unlikely as that sort of sounds, given that context, but it was. My father for many years was a chairman of the theater department at St. Louis University. I grew up wanting to be an actor. So this was a track of my life that I realize is now part of Christopher Marlowe Cobb's, I am very, very close to him in that way, but in terms of his fundamental yearnings, which is what drives fiction. I think even the characters I've written from that are even the most superficially different from me are still very much of me.
Yeah, right, right. I'm glad your phone's ringing. Our phones aren't ringing.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No.
You know, pledging here, and I'm thinking, wow.
Maybe they're calling you instead of us, right?
Yeah, sorry. I'll give you $25, right? But no. That was my cell phone. When you have two phones in your life, this sort of thing happens.
It's terribly complicated, I know. Mm-hmm. My guest this morning is Robert Olin Butler. The book, The Star of Istanbul, is here and available for your donation, $35. And we're drawing down
With book plate, by the way.
With a signed book plate. I know. I'm going to donate the $35 so I can get my book signed.
There you go.
We're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering, I did want to touch on the war being such a personal part of so many of your stories. I know you were in the war. I was a huge fan of A Strange Scent from
A Strange Mountain, right?
Thank you.
If I knew that book was going to win, I would have named it something more memorable that you could remember. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked about my book, A Good Scent from a Strange Woman.
I've always gotten the mountain and the scent part.
Yeah. I was also in a blue... I was identified in a blurb I did for a good friend on his book as the author of A Good Scent from a Cold Mountain. So, I mean, you know,
there you go.
It was just, don't worry about forgetting that title.
But, yeah, we've got 30 seconds, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on sort of how the war has informed a lot of your work over time.
Well, it has, and I think I alluded to something that made it crucial, and that is I spoke fluent Vietnamese from the first day I was in the country. And I worked in military intelligence for 5 months out in the countryside and had a chance to have close encounters with farmers and woodcutters and fishermen and provincial police chiefs. And then I spent 7 months in Saigon working at Saigon City Hall as a translator and administrative assistant, lived in an old French hotel. My favorite thing in the world was every night after midnight to wander the steamy back alleys of Saigon alone where nobody ever seemed to sleep, and to crouch in the doorways with people and immerse myself in their culture, and they're very warm and welcoming people. They invited me into their homes and their lives, and all of that profoundly shaped me as a person, as an artist. And then 18 years later, they all started speaking through me in this book, and after they had gotten thoroughly into my compost heap. And I've been back 4 times since the war, and will forever be connected to all of that.
That's so great. Sadly, as always happens, we have not enough time, but I so appreciate taking the time this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Robert Olin Butler. The book, The Star of Istanbul, is here. We have signed copies. He's offering to sign a book-plated copy for anybody who calls in. Barbara is going to do a little fund drive pitching while I get Russell Banks on the phone, so stay tuned for that. We are looking for just a few donations. Our phones are so incredibly quiet this morning, so give us a call. Show us the love, 949-824-5824. I'm going to turn it over to Barbara for a minute.
Oh, here I am again. That was a wonderful half hour, Marie. I especially like Robert Olin Butler's, it's his writing book, Dare to Dream, Dream to Dare, I don't know. It's about writing, and for you writers out there, check it out if you haven't. It's I like how he says to write before you get out of bed. Anyway, we are in a fun drive, as you know, and... Nobody's called, so we're feeling quite lonely out there. But we need to raise $12,000, and I don't think we're very close. We will stay on the air if you don't call. And we do have money that comes in through UCI to, you know, we have this prefab trailer that our studio's in, thank goodness. But other things like parking and phone calls and water, all of us volunteers pay for these things ourselves. And so your donation helps to keep the lights on. It helps to keep the place running. And, You can call 949-824-5824, or you can go online, KUCI.org, and donate through the website. There you can choose a premium, and if you call while we're here, I should be here till about 11 this morning, Pacific time. You can, if you donate $35, you can get a premium. There are advanced review copies. Robert Olin Butler, who was just on, offered a signed copy of his book. And there's all kinds of reasons to donate, and it's all tax deductible.
And we have copies of Russell Banks' book. Russell is coming on now. We have copies of his book available, too, for your $35 purchase or a dollar donation. And, it's so quiet today.
It's so quiet. So, again, the phone number is 949-824-5824. I'm going back to the phones now.
All right. We will hope for more noise out there. I am incredibly pleased to be joined by Russell Banks. I've been a longtime fan of his. And you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. That's the sound we like to hear. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Russell Banks. His titles include Searching for Survivors, Family Life, Affliction, The Sweet Hereafter. Both those last two were adapted into film. Rule of the Bone, among many others. He has also contributed poems, stories, and essays to the Boston Globe magazine, Vanity Fair, The New York Times Book Review, Esquire, on and on. He's won numerous awards and prizes for his work, including the Guggenheim, National Endowment for the Arts. That also goes on. I could go on. But it's his latest collection of short fiction, A Permanent Member of the Family. It will be out in bookstores next week, November 12th, that we are talking about this morning. Russell, welcome.
Well, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much for coming on. Mm-hmm. I want to give you an opportunity to introduce the collection and maybe talk about your decision to go back to short stories. I know you've done a lot of novel mm-hmm. writing, a lot of short story writing, and in particular, sort of your draw to the short story.
You're right. Well, I had, for years, finish a novel after about 3 years, and then I would sort of take a year or two and write some short stories, and then go back to write a novel again. And I hadn't done that in about a decade, actually since 2001. I had just written novels. And so when I finished this last one, Lost Memory of Skin, I was kind of burnt out in a way and wanted to do nothing except write short stories. And I think it's because you tap into or depend upon a different part of your brain, at least it feels that way, writing short stories than you do writing novels. It's almost as if it's your right side as opposed to your left side. And I think that's because, in many ways, short stories are closer to music and poetry than they are to the novel, the long form. Mm. The proper length, I think, or the best length for a short story is one in which you could still remember the beginning when you get to the end, which is not true for a novel. About page 75 or someplace in a novel, you forget where it began. Whereas with a short story, the echo of the opening scene or lines or voices tend to ring toward the end, or it doesn't really make much sense if you lose that. That's like a musical form or a poetic form more than a novelistic form. So anyhow, I guess what I'm trying to say is that writing these short stories over the last year and a half, after writing novels for 12 years or so, was a wonderful stretch for me. I want to call it relaxing, but it was certainly rejuvenating.
Right. Do you think there are people who are more kind of essentially novelists versus essentially short story writers? Do you think there are people, I mean, you've successfully certainly done both, but it feels like most writers kind of fall on one side of the spectrum or the other.
Right, yeah, or they excel in one. I mean, a lot of writers write both and love to write both, but their gift is clearly in one area or the other. Right. But I don't know. You know, I think it's difficult to be a master, certainly, in both areas, and rare, but not by any means impossible. I mean, we can think of any number of writers. I think, you know, Joyce Carol Oates, John Updike, a few others, and you know, Philip Roth have written wonderful stories. So it's certainly not that uncommon, and does happen.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about this collection in particular. And you know, I think a successful collection such as this, the stories have to be sort of in dialogue with each other. You can't just, you know, write 15 random stories and put them together and make it work as a collection. So talk a little bit about kind of the areas of concern you had when you were thinking about this as a whole.
Well, you know, I actually wrote them all in a block, which I normally wouldn't do. And I went back over notes and jottings and clips that I had collected over the previous decade or longer, and sorted out the ones that seemed to attract me. I didn't have a plan or a program in mind, just what attracts me, what do I want to stay with for a little while. And that turned out to be these 12 stories. Looking at it now, having written the book and put it together and figured out how to work them together, I can see that there are certain kinds of obsessions and themes that recur. Certainly the falling apart of the family, the American family, the disintegration of the American family, I think is apparent in most of the stories. The relationship between children and parents in divorce and in separation was pretty much a big part of these stories over and over again. And then someone pointed out that there's a dog in almost every single story,
yeah, that's
which both pleased and surprised me. But that too is true. Now, don't ask me why that's true, but I have two dogs and I adore them, and so perhaps that's why they ended up walking into the stories.
I'm wondering a little bit about point of view characters, choosing a point of view character for a story, and then for the ancillary characters, how much you need to know, how much you as writer need to know about the ancillary characters if you ever kind of spend time in the other people's point of view, even in your own head, or how much you know, how much you feel like you have to know the people versus novel writing.
Well, I think that you know, the process of writing the story is a process of discovery, and I find out who the characters are through the writing of the story rather than making up a list of characteristics and then trying to enter those into the story in some place or other. And also over the process of revision, you figure out who this person is and who the other characters are in relation to this central person, and so on. So it's really part and parcel of the act of writing rather than, building up a character sketch beforehand for me. And also, the other thing is that most characters end up revealing themselves, you know, through their actions. I might start out with a simple episode in my mind. For instance, there's a story there called Former Marine, and it's about an older man who's lost his job and his mortgage is due and he's run out of money and so forth, and he ends up, you know, committing crimes in order to get some money. And I got that from a newspaper clipping I maybe found 5 or 8 years ago, story of a man who had done exactly that, whose sons were cops, and their sons had to arrest him. And I just thought, oh, wow, that's a situation. I didn't have the character in mind particularly, just the situation. But then in writing the story and unfolding the actions, and letting the actions unfold, the character of the man, the older man, and his sons, one by one, started to appear.
That's so great. My guest this morning is Russell Banks. The book, A Permanent Member of the Family, is his latest collection of short stories. It is available now for your $35 donation. Give us a call, 949-824-5824, 949-UCI-KUCI. In response to The thing that struck me about that story is so often short stories end on these kind of unsatisfying is probably the wrong word, but kind of off-kilter notes where you don't quite know what happened. But in a lot of these stories, we do get an insight into what happened, which I guess is a little more satisfying for the reader, but different than a lot of short stories that I've read. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about endings when you know a story is over, how much to reveal.
Well, I find that usually what happens is that a story can have potentially three endings, and sometimes just two, but usually three. It's working towards three possibilities just out of the unfolding of the story and the unraveling of the actions. And you get down to the last point when you eliminate one, mainly because it seems implausible or unlikely. And then you're down to two, and they're equally likely and equally plausible. And that's in some ways the most interesting and enjoyable part of writing a short story. You can feel almost like the smoke coming out of your ears, because you want to go one way or the other way, and you have to choose. You can't be weak about it. You've got at some point to choose which one conforms to your view of the universe, in a sense, and to your own personal morality and view of human nature. And so I do feel like I'm stuck, at the end of a story. I've got to choose. I can't beg off that responsibility. And I think what you're saying is that when you get to the end of the story, in the stories in this collection, you feel you know what happened, and you know why it happened, and you know the meaning of its happening. That's gratifying to me, because that's the kind of work I feel I have to do in the writing of the story.
Yeah. And that really is unusual. I mean, I really have ended a lot of short stories saying, what the heck just happened here? But
what happened? Yeah, I know. I have the same experience sometimes, and I'm not particularly happy about it. I feel a little stupid sometimes.
Right. I feel like I wasn't let in on the joke after I read it or something.
Right, exactly.
Tell me about writing from, Snowbirds I loved, and your writing from a woman's point of view I really enjoyed, and it just felt so true and authentic.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, tell me.
I'm glad to hear a woman tell me that. That's good.
It is good. Tell me a little bit about writing from the other. Are characters who are very different from you almost easier to access because you kind of have an outsider's perspective, or did any of these characters give you more problems than others?
The ones that give me more problems than others are the ones that more closely resemble me. In a funny way. I think I become then a little self-conscious and a little anxious about writing too close to my own experience and my own life. I'm more comfortable, when I move away from my own life or from characters who sound or look like me or have a similar background. So there are some stories there that I think I had to really reconsider and become very aware of the artifice, in a sense, in order to write. It's a story, the title story, for instance, the narrator of that is a man very much like myself. I mean, someone with a background similar to mine. Mm. And I had to be very aware of the formality of that story and the artificiality, in a sense, of it, in order not to make it a memoir, a personal confession, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a story like, you say, the Snowbird story about the widow, recently widowed woman and her friend, her female friend who comes down from the north to help her, wasn't that difficult for me to write. I know women like that very well personally. I'm related to some. I'm even married to one, and so I have four grown daughters, and so it isn't as though I'm writing about people who are particularly exotic to me in any way or not known to me. So I just don't claim to know what I don't know, and there is a kind of respectful distance that I try to keep with regard to characters, who don't resemble me, either gender-wise or racially or class-wise or anything else. I have to know what I don't know and recognize that. And I think in that case, in that story, and in others like it, I managed to do that. At least I hope so.
Yeah. This is not to say your wife is waiting for you to die, right?
That's right. She might be. I don't think so, though.
Tell me about how your areas of concern have changed over time. These recurring themes of the sort of breaking apart of families, the parental relationships between children, and kind of the disintegration of the American dream here, seems to have permeated your work kind of from, you know, for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it has, yeah.
Yeah. Do you look across the kind of the arc of your work and see where your interests have changed or where they've remained constant?
No, I think they've evolved, changed. They haven't radically changed. Yeah, evolved may be a better word for me to use. You know, every time you sit down to write a novel or a story, in a sense you're trying to penetrate something that's mysterious to you and that you still don't truly understand, and you can only come to some deeper understanding of it through the actual process of writing about it in a fictional form. And so when you do that, then you come to a further understanding and a further mystery beyond that. You know, I've written about, yes, divorce and breakup of families, abandonment and betrayal, and within the family structure and so forth, over and over again, and sometimes from the point of view of the child, sometimes from the point of view of the parent, and you know, it's been there all along. But with each passing work and approach to it, I see it a little differently. I see a greater complexity than I saw the last time. I see maybe certain dimensions of tragedy or of comedy that I didn't see before. So it's a process that's ongoing, and you know, you lay out, I suppose, as I think Flannery O'Connor said, you know, about the age of 14, you lay out pretty much what you're going to write about for the rest of your life, or at least you know what you're going to write about if you turn out to be a writer. Hmm. And you don't really find new material very often. And it's sort of been the case with me, I'm sure. By the time I was 14, you know, my family had been busted up by divorce and abandonment and poverty and alcoholism and violence. And so, in a way, those subjects have stayed with me, but I've approached them from many different angles and with many different levels of understanding and curiosity as the years have gone by.
Right. That raises an interesting question about whether you take that bulk of experience that you had and then you read a new story about, you know, that inspired the former Marine, the mm-hmm. bank robbing guy. And, you know, is it your experience that caused you to seek that article out and be interested in it, or is it your experience that you kind of put onto that article and then spin the story out into what it became?
Yeah, I think that it starts with my level of attraction to begin with. I'm attracted to certain kinds of stories or certain kinds of people and certain kinds of situations, and that I'm barely even conscious of why or that I am, but I know I am. And so, yeah, if I'm skimming through a newspaper or I'm listening to something on the radio or listening to someone talk in the next booth in a restaurant, I pick up on certain things and I miss a whole lot of other stuff for those reasons. It's sort of like when you learn a new word or your attention is drawn to a new word, you suddenly start hearing it everywhere, you know. but that word was there all along. But you know, you can hear it everywhere. Or you know, I for instance, at one point I got really interested in chimpanzees, and I can't tell you particularly why. And then, but I wrote a novel about a woman who was, had built a sanctuary for chimpanzees, and I've been obsessed with chimpanzees ever since. And only recently did I. When I was asked a question of one of these literary questionnaires about what book was the first book you remember reading, I remembered reading Toby Tyler, The Boy Who Ran Away with the Circus. And I went and got a copy, and I started rereading it, and I realized that there's a chimpanzee is a major character in that book. And I read it probably when I was 5 or 6 years old. And I think that chimpanzee was so striking to me, and that story was so striking to me, when I was 5 or 6 years old, has counts of the fact that I've had chimpanzees in my novels and fiction for many years since.
Be careful what you expose
really
your children
to. You can't predict why you're attracted to these things.
right. But you can control what you expose your 5-year-old to, because it'll haunt him for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm afraid that's true.
My guest this morning is Russell Banks, author of A Permanent Member of the Family, which is going to be out next week. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is your, so you had two of your novels adapted into film, and you're also the screenwriter of a film adaptation of Continental Drift, which leads me to believe that you're a very visual person, perhaps. And I'm wondering how much you kind of draw on the visual to transcribe this onto the page.
Well, I think it's not something that I set out to do in my writing, but early on I believed, and I still do believe, that if I can't see what it is that I'm writing, that I'm describing, then I'm doing something wrong, that I'm hiding whatever I'm writing about rather than revealing what I'm writing about. And it's the same thing with dialogue. If I can't hear the character speaking, then I'm doing something wrong. I believe that what happens when we read fiction is that we sort of experience out-of-the-body travel in a way. We start to hallucinate. We see things that aren't there in the room with us, and we hear things that aren't there being said in the room with us. And that seeing and hearing is a really important experience for the reader. And therefore, it's equally important, and just as important, certainly, for the writer. I have to see and hear what it is that I'm writing when I'm writing. And so now, all that means is just, it's an elaborate way to answer your question. What it means is that when the reader picks up a book or a story of mine, they usually can see the action unfolding, whatever it is, or the scene, or the room, or people in it. Mm-hmm. And probably that makes the novels in some ways seem as though they're easy to adapt or quick to adapt to film. What happens is, of course, they then realize that the stories are really kind of dark and a little bit depressing at times. And I had one review years ago for a book that began with the line, I think it was in People magazine, it began, "Another bummer from Banks." And I think that it gets, someone reads the book and says, "Oh, this would make a good film. I can see the whole thing." And then they sit down and they start writing it as a screenplay, and they realize it's pretty depressing. It all ends badly for everybody.
Those are my favorite films, though.
I know, mine too.
In fact, I have to share with you that I'm a member of a movie club. We screen a movie, every couple of weeks. So we every couple of months. So The Sweet Hereafter was my movie that I brought out as my all-time favorite film. So it's
good.
Long-time fan.
I was really lucky with that one. I mean, Adam Egoyan is such a brilliant director, and he did such a good job with a book that was almost impossible to adapt. It was narrated by four different narrators, the novel is, and there's no central character that holds the story together. It's a community, an ensemble, really, of characters. And he managed to make an eloquent and elegant and elegiac film out of it that was really true to the spirit of the novel.
It really was.
Enormously.
Yeah. It's rare that a film can do justice to a novel, but it was really, really well done. We're unfortunately drawing down on our time. Do you have any last-minute words of writing advice to aspiring writers?
Oh, well, most when I speak to young writers, I first always say, don't quit your day job, that's for sure. But I think that the best thing that it's good for young writers to remember is to keep their work and their career entirely separate from each other, because you can control your work, but you can't control your career. And if you get the two mingled together, you end up, in a way, screwing up both. Hmm. So I think that most young writers need to keep conscious of the need to separate those two. Okay. You need to stay, on separate tracks entirely.
Yeah, good advice. Russell Banks, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. That was Russell Banks. His latest short story collection is A Permanent Member of the Family. It is out and available in bookstores next week, and it is available today for your $35 donation. We are here all week. We're here through Friday, but you can donate by giving us a call, 949-824-5824. You can donate online, kuci.org. I guess you can donate at any time, but no amount is too small. $5, $10. You know, if you skip going to Starbucks this morning and throw that money our way, we are greatly appreciative of it. And like I say, we've got a lot of premiums here. We've got yoga classes and books, tons and tons of books. We've got Robert Olin Butler's signed copy of The Star of Istanbul, which is just out now. And I think there's gift certificates to restaurants and CDs. We've also got a student level available now. For a $20 donation, you get a limited edition KUCI license plate frame in UCI blue and gold colors. Any donation from $20 up gets one of those fantastic license plates. And if you donate at the $200 level, you get to host your own one-hour radio show here, one-time show. People will help you out, so you won't be thrown to the wolves. But it is fun. We had a longtime listener come in last year and sit in on the show. She said she'd never seen how radio works, so she had a great time doing that. So anyway, Barbara, Nicole, and I are all here. We're all taking your calls for the next little bit, and we'll be taking your calls through Friday. That's when the fun drive ends, but we so appreciate anything you can give us. 949-824-5824. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you. I think Barbara and Nicole will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.